Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This week in Retronauts, a long-forgotten friend makes good on an old promise. Everyone, and welcome to this episode of Retronauts, whatever episode it is. I'm Jeremy Parrish, hosting this time around, and this is a very special episode because it's one that should have happened like 5 years ago, and it's finally happening now. So get out your little Oprah, it's happening GIFs, and celebrate.
Look under your chair right now.
Right now.
You'll find.
There's a car, a free car.
There's a creepy guy with a mullet recommending a shooter for the Genesis. He's hiding.
Yes, that's right. Call Shane Bettenhausen is here, along with Christian Nutt. And we're finally going to do the Nihon Telenet / Valise episode. That's cool.
Well, you know, this company has such a weird, twisted, fractured history. It only makes sense that it took a very long time for us to kind of like, you know, bring up the energy to actually make this happen.
That's an interesting justification.
Yeah.
First, before we get into this, though, let's introduce ourselves. I'm Jeremy Parrish. To my left, not that you can hear because this is not in quadraphonic stereo.
Yeah. I'm Christian Nutt, Gama Sutra's blog director, and I've been on Retronauts many times, I guess.
It sounds like you just made that title up.
It's not true.
What am I? What
is my title? Did not make it up.
Well, and I'm Shane Bettenhausen. I used to be on Retronauts forever ago, a long time ago. I work at PlayStation now.
And I'm Bob Mackey. You know me.
And I think we're just going to jump pretty much straight into this episode. Back in the 1UP days, in the olden Retronauts times, you know, when Shane left the company, he said, at some point, I'm going to come back and do a Valise episode. That was one of the things that's a company and a game series he holds dear to his heart. And so we've wanted to make this happen for a long time. And now here we are.
And it's been difficult because, you know, as I went to different positions at different publishers, sometimes I wasn't allowed to do podcasts, even podcasts about ancient, you know, antiques such as these.
And right. And as long as we don't talk about getting Valise, those Valise releases on PSN America.
There's nothing happening there, but you know, to fast forward to the very end.
How is there not anything happening?
Well, I'll say,
how are you working at PlayStation knowing that these games are on Japanese PSN and not saying,
oh, they
you know
are.
What?
A few of them are here and there in Japan on PSN. But in terms of, you know, fast forward to the end of this spoiler alert, allegedly Sunsoft has the rights to all these games now. And at Tokyo Game Show, I was speaking to someone who controls those rights about if we could one day bring these back. So, like, yeah, it would be amazing if all of these games we talk about today could be played. You know, something.
Direct from his mouth, folks.
But, tell them they can keep
Shane Bettenhausen doing the Lord's work.
These things take time, especially with you know, like classics emulation. I think you know, people were excited to see Viv Ribbon, for example, finally came out in America on PS1 Classics some decade after it originally came out. So things are possible. So keep
problem with that
alive.
Game is I can't seem to get a compact disc into my Vita. So it's
a PS3 will work it with it.
Yeah, actually.
I'm really glad that Christian's here because Christian and I are friends from a really long time ago.
Before, it is a long time ago.
Right, before either of us were ever in the video game world, when we were just, you know, fans, actually. And I think, you know, to kind of hijack this from you, I think that Christian and I both have really unique perspectives on Telenet. Me, as back in the day, back in 16-bit, I was a Genesis fanboy, more or less. I never had Turbo, so I was always looking at
– I introduced you to the world of TurboGrafx.
He did. And I was looking at screenshots of like Cosmic Fantasy Stories and being like, oh man, that looks amazing. I wish I could play that, but I can't. And it wasn't until Renovation on Genesis that I got to touch it. Meanwhile, Christian, kind of anyone here, probably had the earliest touch on any Telenet product by having a TurboGrafx CD on like the day it came out.
Well, not quite the day it came out, but it was – well, I mean – I'm sure I bought the first one that Toys R Us ever sold.
In its giant plastic carrying case, which you could have, like, carried a person inside of.
Yeah, the box for that thing is literally big enough to carry, like, a large child.
Right. And Valis 2 was a launch title. Did you get it?
I got Valis 2 right when it came out. That would have been 1990.
I believe that was one of the two launch – or three launch?
No, the two launch titles for the actual TurboGrafx CD were Monster Lair and Fighting Street. Fighting Street being Street Fighter 1.
Right, right, right. Valis 2 is not there.
Valis 2 came out later. It was probably the fall, early fall or late summer of 90.
And did you know about it? Had you seen the one screenshot that was
– I don't remember. Like, so basically what happened is – I don't know if this is how we want to segue into talking about the history of Telnet, but like
I have a feeling I'm going to have no control
over
this.
I think we should rewind. So, once anyone's first touch of Telnet. Like,
yeah.
Well, actually, why don't we even talk about what Telnet is? And I'd actually – like I'm putting this forward as a question to you guys because I did a lot of research for this episode because Telnet and Valis are not really in my wheelhouse.
Right.
And I've struggled over the years to enjoy Valis, and I just can't because I think I wasn't there at the time.
You kind of had to be there.
Yeah. I wasn't there at
the time. I'm in Jeremy's camp too.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of reading and tried to figure out, you know, exactly what Telnet was. It seems like it was this massive octopus-like company.
I don't think it was massive.
It didn't produce that many games, but, you know, a few dozen throughout its life. But the thing is it had all these subdivisions.
Yeah.
So it's a really strange company, and there's no real narrative about the company.
And the subdivisions have kind of unique, interesting.
Oh yeah,
the whole
Wolf Team thing. Right. Like, yeah. We could probably do an episode just on Wolf Team.
I mean,
honestly,
clearly the founder, when it was founded, there was this one dude. I forget his name. If I have it here. But you know, he was clearly ambitious. You know, because it was for a small corporation, very ambitious, and they made a lot of content.
Yeah. They started out making PC games, and one other thing that complicates this,
Most Japanese developers,
PC 88.
If you look back and you look at some of the versions of their games that came out for certain consoles, they didn't actually produce them. It's kind of like the Falcom situation we talked about ages ago. Like the Famicom, meaning NES versions of Valis games, those are not them. And the Famicom Valis 1 is like an amazing – can I curse on this show?
Go ahead.
Clusterfuck of just like what the shit is this game. But that's a fun one.
Interestingly different from other versions, right. It should be mentioned,
you know, tying in with that the Valis series started out on Japanese PCs, the PC-88 and the MSX.
So actually,
Those early versions look pretty bad.
Well, the hardware was pretty bad.
Sure. Like all platformer, 2D platformers for PCs made in the 80s.
That didn't have dedicated scrolling hardware.
Yeah. I mean, it was not a good match.
Or sprite handling.
But God bless them for trying.
Well, the thing was, I mean, they did this thing that, you know, was discovered sort of very, I think, early on in the Japanese market, which was, like, if we put in really, really high quality, like, still anime cutscenes, like, we will find a niche audience that will really appreciate it. This was during the boom of, like, you know, 80s anime, which was, you know, when the sort of anime as appreciated by people who were adults, not kids, started to become a thing.
I think, you know, any conversation along this phase of history, kind of you have to understand that when we're talking about Japan – like the 80s encompassed a video game boom with the Famicom. It encompassed an anime boom. It encompassed an economic boom. And all these things fit together.
Yeah.
And
people were buying new PCs all the time, new consoles.
These things are all conflated just by their existence. Like they all happened in concert.
The economic and cultural overlap was that as the economic boom was happening, like there was suddenly big budgets for games,
people had a ton of disposable income at that point.
Budgets for anime productions that were very high budget and painstakingly made, creative and weird to some extent, and it all sort of conflated. And so they made Valis,
and I also believe the Valis, you know, was kind of ripped from what was popular. It was like a magical girl transformation narrative, which at the time, like Sailor Moon, was brand new.
This predates Sailor Moon. Manga began. I looked this up because I was like, is this just a Sailor Moon ripoff? The manga actually, Clamp began the manga in 1991.
Takeuchi.
Sailor Moon began as a manga in 1991.
Wow. Okay.
Sailor V predated,
but there were other magical girls.
But Valis was 1986.
I was
reading
the
Hardcore Gamer 101.
That's what I was going to say.
They cited Retta, the Fantastic Adventure of Yoko, as the influence.
That's true. It is a little darker, more demonic than Sailor Moon.
Oh yeah, way.
Never gets.
The demons are actually. So that's something I'll talk about probably. But no, I mean for sure. Telnet, like, they started out on PC, but I'm really – and I just did this big feature on TurboGrafx. I'm not sure how they courted –
fantastic, yeah.
Thank you. How they courted these developers.
Yeah, I was jealous of that piece, honestly.
Well, that's high praise from you because you're so – this is your thing.
You're wasting your time on Game Boy.
Oh,
I agree with. Sorry, should I do PSP instead?
Perhaps I agree with Mark McDonald his assertion of what playing a game on the Game Boy is like. I'm not going to repeat it here because you have young listeners, but
he's already gotten us an explicit label.
Yeah, go for it.
No, just saying that it's like sipping a fine champagne through a device you wouldn't want to sip champagne through.
I recently played through Super Mario Land beginning to end. I felt it was charming.
It's weird, but
anyway,
blurry and unplayable.
Back to Valorant.
You play on original Game Boy hardware.
I played on a GBA SP backlit.
If I had a Game Boy Light, maybe. Anyway.
So
get one.
I don't know exactly how they got to the TurboGrafx, but essentially I think this is like either they decided, which would be logical, like, oh, look, CD-ROM. Like, we have to remember, like, CD-ROM was a brand new thing.
Do you think Hudson maybe, like, paid them?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, Hudson did – I found out when I was doing my research that Hudson was not only – paying, you know, encouraging people to make games for the system, but they were also, in fact, like, funding games and then giving them to other publishers to release under their name to, like, give the impression that there were more third-party games. However, that is definitely
That's
not the case
clever.
With Telenet, because they made a shit ton of games on their own Steam, so it's clear that they actually embraced the PC Engine.
But they might have used, like, you know, a co-marketing deal or something on Cosmic Fantasy.
Oh, yeah, no, there absolutely, there's some way that, I'm sure there was some sort of, but, you know, Japan is also very relationship-based, so it's altogether possible they just liked each other. Yeah. Like, that's actually a feasible way to do business.
Well, and the versions for PC Engine were better than the versions on the PCs.
Well, so this is, there's a lot of tangled things here. Let me try to, like, smooth them back out and tell them in order. So this company made some PC games. They made the Valus series. They made Valus 1. Then they made Valus 2. And Valus 2 sort of breakthrough, I guess, was it really had the anime thing going. And
cutscenes.
Right around the same time, the PC Engine was getting its CD-ROM drive, which was 1980. I guess it might have been 88 in 87? Japan. No, 87 was the system. It was PC Engine. But I think it just made the tail end of 88 in Japan, if I recall correctly. But so in 89, they're making, you know, the first wave of real CD games are coming. And I guess, you know, whether Telnet was invited because of their sort of incipient prowess of making CD-ROM style graphics, or whether they're just like, oh, hey, we can jump on that and really do the kind of cinematics we want to do. Either way, that's how they ended up there. Now, they, as we talked about, or Jeremy started to talk about, Telenet is the overarching company, but they had a bunch of different labels with different names that release games on different platforms.
I mean, were they just labels, or were they?
No, they were actually
studios.
Yeah. They were studios. Like,
Wolf Team is very
specific.
Yeah, I was
going to say Wolf Team doesn't strike me as being
but
a label, but
Riot
a group
is
of
a label and not a studio.
All right,
I
and Renovation was just like their American label.
And also,
but they used the Renovation brand in Japan.
And then there's CD – they did. And there's also CD
so
Laser.
So CD LaserSoft.
And I love LaserSoft.
CD LaserSoft. Yeah, I actually love that logo and everything. CD LaserSoft did Valus 2 around the same time that, like, the PC group was doing Valus 2. There's, like, a little bit of a lag. So clearly they were, like, concurrently developed by different teams. So CD LaserSoft is the one that was sort of founded to do the PC Engine games. And they did Valus 2, Valus 3 – but Valus and Valus 4, but Valus 1, which finally came out as the final release of Valus on PC Engine, because it's a remake of the old PC one, that was Riot.
It's also the last Valus released for Genesis, weirdly enough, too, which I have the manual of here, but yeah.
So there's, because Valus 1 was originally an old PC game, so for them to get back around to remaking it, I think it took a while. Right. But so the different brands they had were, there was Telnet was the company, there was CD LaserSoft, which was PC Engine. They did make some, like, the Valus 4 release for Super Famicom is released under CD LaserSoft, which is hilarious because it's a cartridge.
It's published by Atlas here. Weirdly,
whatever.
And kind of reworked.
But there's CD LaserSoft, there's Wolf Team, there's Renovation, there's Riot. Am I leaving out anything?
I think that's about it.
I think that's everything.
Yeah.
So there's sort of, but all under the publisher Telenet. So.
Yeah. Well, and which, was it Riot who did Cosmic Fantasy? Or
okay, so or Cosmic Wolf? Fantasy, I believe, was.
I believe it's Riot and not Wolf Team.
I don't have – like the only Cosmic Fantasy release I have a Japanese version of is Cosmic Fantasy Stories for the Mega CD, which is a port of 1 and 2, and that is Riot. Hmm.
And like Cosmic Fantasy 2 was one of the big first releases here for TurboGrafx CD-ROM that had voices and cutscenes.
Well, that was
an RPG.
The first – so to go back to your original question before we got sort of into the little bit of the history was I – had bought the TurboGrafx CD in August of 90. Did it come out in, I guess, the end of 89 in America? It took me a while to get interested in the system. I didn't buy the actual TurboGrafx until the summer of 90. I got very into it. I got very obsessed with it. I liked it a lot. And then I saw East 1 and 2, which, like, in EGM and stuff, and I was like, holy shit, I need this game. Like, I desperately need this game.
I think this is a time when both of us, you know, we were kind of coming to terms with, like, realizing that the kinds of games we had liked on NES and, you know, Master System, whatever, were these Japanese games with this anime art style. And suddenly, you're looking at screenshots, and there is, like, a beautiful anime girl with blue hair in this game. And that's the game for me.
Can you guys talk about what kind of anime you were watching at the time? I'm just curious.
Oh.
Yeah, and what kind of anime do you watch now?
This was before anime was readily available in stores. There was just no Suncoast.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about 1990, so I actually, the first time I watched anime as anime in the sense that it was, like, I knew this was, like, distinct from watching a cartoon on television with, like, commercials and whatever, like, was Akira, but that wasn't until 91.
Right. Okay. This was before anime, basically. And, like, this realization...
Well, before anime in America.
Right. Yeah. That these games that looked like, you know, Robotech or Gundam or Rumiko Takahashi...
It was more... For me, it was a natural extension of the fact that, like I bought a Genesis... well, no, actually, probably not in that order. But, like, I played, you know, RPGs. Like, I found RPGs. Like, I really loved Phantasy Star 1 on the Master System, and I just had this sense that, like, I want more games like this. And that dovetailed with the aesthetic that I then, like, I didn't realize anime, like, per se was an aesthetic until I got East 1 and 2, really, and sort of put it together in my head with some of the cartoons I'd seen, like Robotech or whatever, and sort of had this idea, like, hey, this is a thing. And this is not a thing for kids necessarily. And that was kind of, you know, like, I was 13, so, you know, when you're 13, it's like, you're starting to grow up and you're starting to develop your own taste and you're starting to understand, like, there's a differentiation between things for kids and things for you. And, like, I was like, this is the kind of thing that I want.
And I'm kind of good getting to that. For me, Telenet Games, like, and they have a lot of – yeah, there were a lot of titles released between, like, 1990 and 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And playing those games during those formative years, it actually helped to kind of foster my love of the anime aesthetic. And I think, in a way, a lot of their games have this generic – 70s, 80s anime aesthetic.
Yeah, they're
that's pleasant and, you know,
it's nostalgic.
Dependable.
I think what it is that, like, what they were doing was they were highly influenced by what was going on. Like, you know, like Hardcore Gaming mentions, you know, Leda was one of their influences. They were very influenced by what was in the air, right? Probably the artists who were working in there were more drawing their inspiration from, like, what was in the air than they were coming up with original things. However, I think that if you look at some of their games, like we can talk about, they had a highly refined, like, implementation of those things. Like, the character designs were good, interesting. The art, like, particularly games like Gyarus had really interesting art direction for the Genesis cutscenes.
Right. And good music
that are different
throughout as well.
Yeah. So and so I got the TurboGrafx CD in August of 90. Valis came out soon after. I sort of had to pick. I had Monster Lair at launch and there were no other games. There were those two games.
Literally two.
Monster Lair. Yeah. And I was like, what am I going to – I kept going to, like – I mean, this wasn't, like, really – it was just around the time I was starting to read magazines. So I just kept going to, like, stores and looking to see if anything had spawned on the shelves. And finally, like, I believe it was Valis and maybe it was Final Zone 2 or maybe it was – no, it was Last Alert, I think. One of the other
– which is also
– these are all Telenet
games.
Yeah. Like, basically, like, NEC was pumping out Telenet's games in America. And I sort of had to pick. There was two. I think it was Last Alert. And, like, Last Alert is, like – even back then, it was like a butch guy with a gun, and I'm like, no. And then this one's like super cool anime, and I'm like, yes. So, like, that is what I bought. And I just – to sort of go, like – so Monster Lair is, in my opinion, a really good game, and I still really cherish it. But it didn't have cutscenes or any other stuff we associate with, like, CD-ROM. It had CD music, but otherwise it was, like, you know, pretty much doable cartridge.
So Valis 2 was the first Valis game to come to the U.S.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not sure, like, because Valis 3 for Genesis would have been the next.
Right, which was at least a full year afterwards.
Actually, didn't Cid of Valis come between 2 and 3, or was that
no,
after
No, Cid of Valis is a remake of Valis 2, and it came out after Valis 3.
Okay. Yeah, we're talking about chronology of release, not chronology of, like...
Yeah, Valis 2 was by far the first Valis thing. And so, I think the first CD-ROM game with, like, lots of voices.
Yeah, no, it was the first one with anime cutscenes. And, like, I... Not only did it have,
and
like...
What did you think of those load times? Like, the first time one of the cutscenes is loading, and you, like, had 10, like, 15 seconds?
Well, I mean, okay, so first of all, we're talking about a very different time. Like, I had a C64 with a disk drive,
right.
So the load times on, like, a TurboGrafx CD at the time, while, like, kind of long and certainly nothing, like, people would put up with today, I was like, eh, like, it was not bothering me.
I don't know. I just played through Assassin's Creed Unity.
That's true. But like, what sort of blew my mind about it is, like, It's not – it's and this is what I think Jeremy, like, he was getting into. Like, he doesn't quite get it. You had to be there. And you definitely did. But, like, what it was is, like, it's very dark and it's very, like, mature for the time. Like,
serious.
It's serious. Like, yes, it's an honor. I know. We can look at this.
I mean, it really – it seems to me, like, you know, looking back and playing, that it was tapping into the same kind of vibe, both in terms of gameplay and in terms of – presentation that Tecmo was doing with Ninja Gaiden at the exact
it
same
is.
Time.
Like, Ninja Gaiden 2 and Valis 2 are a little similar,
like,
actually.
Yeah, the beginning of Valis 2, like, you know.
All that demonic stuff. Right. Like, that was actually really common in anime at the time. Yeah. That sort of, like, I mean, Megami Tensei and Utsuka Doji.
And by not
and
having
Valis
1,
like,
you kind of miss the whole, like, starting out as a regular school student and, like, and you kind of go straight into, like, King of the Underworld.
Well, it's really interesting. Yeah. She's like woken up. It's like, this is the story of Valis 2 if you don't, like, especially if you don't know Valis 1, of course, we didn't because it didn't exist in America. So, like, there's this high school girl who at the time was older than me, actually, because I was, like, 13, woken up at night, threatened. She, like...
Is it Cham who comes? Or
no, she just, like, I can't remember why, but she basically, like, you know, finds out I think she has, like, a vision or something. She has to...
Just to go back to
no, there's a flashback at the beginning, like her dead friend Reiko, who was the sort of villain and heroine of the first game, not that we knew,
right.
Talking to her, what the fuck is going on? She's like in battle armor. Suddenly she's like the first level of Valis 2. I should have played this before talking, but she's actually in her like sailor
pajamas.
Suit.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
No, that's Valis 3 is the pajamas.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
She's in her sailor suit, but she gets the sword of Valis and she's like running through Tokyo at night and it's filled with demons. And this is actually like. And the music is really atmospheric. And then as you get to, like, you get through, you get to this, you know, boss fight. And this guy challenges you. And you fight him and you defeat him. And then this other guy comes in and just chops him in half. And they fucking show the bisected,
it's really bloody,
gory corpse.
Wow.
Of the character.
Yeah.
And if you want to see that, I made an awesome animated GIF of it and put it on Gama Sutra. So...
yeah, so, like, it kind of delivered, like, this is what people in Japan are playing. Holy shit.
And,
you know,
I was...
This is the same era of NES. NES hadn't really peaked yet.
This sort of family of anime, that this aesthetic, had, you know, it all worked with this kind of similar color palette, a lot of purples and really dark colors that just were really... You know, a big contrast to most NES games of the time, you know, and the sort of thing that most Americans were playing on NES or Genesis.
It's hard to explain, I think, for people who weren't there at the time, particularly a lot like younger listeners, because they came up in this world of like omnipresent everything.
Yeah.
But like at the time, you know, like I think you can relate, like probably depending, like I was 13, right? Like I was starting to read like novels for adults. I was reading a lot. I mean, these are not like literature, but I was reading a lot of.
So you were reading Philip K. Dick and you were like, oh, it's a game based on
novelization.
I was reading Stephen King.
I was reading a lot of like Dean Koontz, which is like far from literature. But the point is I was reading a lot of like macabre stories. I was trying to get a sense of like what I thought was interesting or, you know, I was reading weird sci-fi stories and just like starting to get a bead on like, this is the culture for me as I get older. And, like, this slotted into it. Like, it really – the transition between, like, NES and, like, Super Mario Brothers 3 and then, like, literally, like, 6 months later I'm playing this.
Yeah. Were you able to finish Valis 2? Because I'll say, like, I went back and played it in post after having played Valis 3. And it is a little wonkier. The controls are a little mushier.
Well, that's the thing we're going to get into.
That's why I've had trouble getting back into them because – you know, as much as the aesthetic is interesting and I like the visual style and the overall, like, oh, yeah, 80s anime, hell yeah. Like, as a game, it's
cumbersome.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Also, it's like it's your average, like, 45-minute long game from, like, the era. Like, I played through it again probably, like, 5 years ago, but, like, recently enough that I recall.
I feel like, was there a Game Center CX episode about Valis, or
maybe
I just watched a Let's Play of it? It was a very similar kind of experience.
And a lot, you know, if you haven't, you mentioned SD Valis, Cid of Valis, which is a remake of Valis 2, which came out later, which is easier.
Well, the weird thing about it, Valis 2 came out, and then like you know, like I said, so the thing with the TurboGrafx was like there were no third party publishers. NEC was publishing almost everything, literally almost everything in the West. Themselves, and they started pumping out Telenet's games, but like there didn't seem to be any like rhyme or reason to like how fast or when they would come out. And like as someone who was like had the system, I was like always scouting out. So I played Valis 2, and then the next game I got was East 1 and 2, which came out around the Christmas of
91.
So you're kind of building, like, this is my jam.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I got it for Christmas as a Christmas present. I was super excited. I remember bothering my mother, like, make sure, like, you know, you hire when, like, you're young. I was still 13. You're still young enough to kind of be an annoying kid. Like, this better be there. Like, this is the thing that I want the most. Like, please tell me that you got this. Until she finally said, yes, I got it. Will you, like, leave me alone?
You spent Christmas in Darm Tower.
Yes. So, you know, I was building into this. And then... But, like, the thing – it's not, like, the omnipresent information of today. Like, you did not know what was coming when or if it was coming. It might disappear. It might fall off the radar. Like,
chip
sure
shortage.
There was EGM.
Yeah, I'm like, sure that back then, you know, the people who worked at the camera department of most of the department stores in the city where I lived were sick of me calling, like, once a week saying, do you have Zelda 2?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I would –
oh, not until 6 months from now. Shut up, kid.
I would find out – like the games I wanted were – I knew what games I wanted were out because I was at this point reading EGM. But, like, there were not release dates. There were not pre-orders. Like, I would just call EB and say, like, did you get it? And then if they got it, like, I would bother my mom to, like, take me there. Like, I remember when East 3 came out, I, like, called Babbage's at the mall and I'm like, did you get East 3? And they're like, yeah, we have it. Like, we've had it for a couple days. I'm like, whoa, I guess I didn't call recently. Like, can you – like, how many do you have? She's like, we have a couple copies. I'm like, well, mom, got to go. You know, like, this is, like, how it was. But yeah, at the same time, to sort of get back to what you were saying, like at the same time, the TurboGrafx like was floundering and NEC was being forced to release all their games from the third parties themselves, like Renovation, which was the American arm of Telenet, like booted up as a Genesis publisher in 1990.
Well, and that's where I got excited because I was an early Genesis adopter. I loved my Genesis from day one. And I saw that Renovation was starting to bring games to the US. The first one, Final Zone and Gain Ground, which wasn't even their game. And Granada, which was their
game. Wait, Renovation published Game Ground?
Yeah, they did.
Even though it's a Sega first-party game?
Right, Sega developer.
That's really weird.
How
weird
is that? I think it was in Japan. I think it might have been not Sega also. I think it might have been like one of those like licensing deals or something.
Huh. Hmm. But anyway, so I remember I rented Final Zone, and I liked it, but it didn't have any of the anime aesthetic that I'd seen in like Valis and even though it's by Wolf Team. And it wasn't until...
Where's my foofy hair, damn
right.
it?
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until Valis 3, which like launched, simultaneously.
Okay.
That I really got a taste of that Valis magic. And then I was hooked. And that game was so much better than I thought it would have been because it had three distinct characters that had very different play styles and, like, unique stories.
Another weird thing about these games is that, like, the versions of them for other consoles are really not the same game. They didn't come out at the same time. Like, it's not like today when you buy, I don't know, to bring back your favorite example, Assassin's Creed Unity on Xbox One or PS4 and it's the same game. It's like... No, different teams, like, at the same company made different versions using the same basic ideas but, like, different implementations.
I mean, you've already brought up Nihon Falcom, and they applied that a practice with games like East a lot.
Oh, yeah. They licensed all the console versions of the East 1 and were, like, in the old days where East 1 and 2 were, like, licensed out in 3.
And actually, didn't Telenet publish one of the versions of East 3?
East 3 for... The Genesis version of East 3 is actually a renovation game developed by Telenet.
Yeah.
Well,
that port.
And like for me, Valis 3 actually exceeded my expectations because I hadn't played Valis 2 at that point, and I thought it was like legitimately a good game. I think EGM gave it like all 8s, and like I remember thinking, wow, you know, this developer that I've been excited about is actually pretty good. And like Renovation started to be prolific and put out a lot of content on Genesis really quickly.
Yeah, they have probably like what 20, 25 Genesis games.
Yeah, including weird stuff like Dino Land, a fun pinball game.
Didn't they have like a that insect shooter.
Insector X. They
yes, that's it.
They weren't the original developer of that.
Well,
that
no, but they published it.
They published it. Sage's Creation was
Sage's
the developer
Creation,
of that.
Right.
But things like Arcus Odyssey, which they developed, which was really good.
Arcus Odyssey is a neat game. I played through that with Brendan Sheffield a while, like 6 months ago. It's fun.
You know, El Viento and what's the...
Ernest Evans.
Ernest Evans.
Well, that's the other thing. That's the weird thing. We can get into that for like 30 seconds if we want. But like El Viento, Ernest Evans, and Annette
Futami
are a series.
They are.
A loose series.
It's a loose series.
We can maybe talk about that later.
We can.
Actually,
but I do better bring up
that's
one more kind of forgotten one that probably no one else has played. They had two RPGs for Genesis, Trazia, and the other one's Sorcerer's Kingdom. And they're both pretty solid, actually, like traditional RPGs that not many people have played.
There's
also Exile.
There's like, and so like sort of parallel, this sort of dovetails with another, I'm sure we can give a link to like the Working Designs episode, but like Working Designs was like got its start on the TurboGrafx. And the first things they started to do after they did two Taito games was to start releasing some Telenet games. And Cosmic Fantasy 2 for the TurboGrafx was like, you sort of said earlier, one of the first like fully voiced CD-ROM JRPGs. God, I hate saying JRPGs about old ones. RPGs.
Like kind of treated with special care too, you know, like the packaging and whatnot.
Yeah, no, it was like, well.
Yeah.
The illustration on the front cover may not be special care.
That's true.
Maybe a different definition of special.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, at the time, it was exciting and fresh. And, like, you didn't know. You did not live in this omnipresent soup of information and marketing. You didn't know what you were getting into.
Right.
You were just trying to find the things that would most interest you. And it was really during the 16-bit era, like, sort of as Sega perfected the marketing of console games, where, like, we sort of moved towards this modern notion of, like, this is what everyone buys at the same time. Like, you know, everyone likes the same shit.
And it's interesting. On Retronauts, I was listening to, someone said that shmups for a hot second in 16-bit Genesis era were like the dude bro shooter, like the thing to market of the moment. And at that moment, when that was the hottest thing going, when Thunder Force 3 was like mind-bendingly beautiful.
And there was a dude promoting Gaiares with a
solid nines. Right after Thunder Force 3 is when Renovations Gaiares hit. And in many ways is one of the most impressive shmups on Genesis. My favorite personal is Musha, but like Gaiares actually has the best graphics, like aesthetically and technically, probably the best.
That's
graphics.
A good example of like of sort of the Telnet's like excellence in like it has anime cutscenes. Of course, since the Genesis, they just have text. But the character designs are very distinctive, and I don't feel like that art style that they use in Gaiares is like really. Like, I could point to another example.
It's almost like Langrisser or something.
Yeah,
it's weird.
It's really interesting and unique. And then the game itself has really good music, really big bosses, that like screen-filling bosses,
right.
Which was like it's kind of the same. It was the same back then in a sense that is today. Like, it was an arms race. All the publishers and developers were trying to outdo each other to see who could, like, wring the most out of the
Bigger
Genesis.
Bosses, more levels of parallax, longer levels. And Gaiares has the most levels, the biggest bosses.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's an amazing game if you haven't played it.
It's just like, Renovation became this label that was like pumping out Genesis games.
And I think this kind of segues into what they were doing for PC Engine CD. They suddenly became even more so for Mega CD. I mean, it's almost as if when you're looking through the Mega CD racks in Japan, like 33% of the content is by some version of Telnet.
Yeah, it's
I believe it.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts.
Like, the
launch
like,
titles were almost all Telnet games.
A lot of people have nostalgia for the Genesis, and especially if you weren't there at the time. I mean, even if you were there at the time, you weren't. It's hard to know this stuff. Like, the Genesis really was not at all popular in Japan. Like, as a platform, the Genesis, like, the Mega Drive, as it's called there and in Europe, is, like, no one bought it. It was, like, a distant third place
right.
in the 16-bit era. I mean, I love the Genesis, so I'm not, like, dumping on it. I'm just being honest, right?
Right.
And the Mega CD was the add-on to the unpopular system. So, like, really, I don't know how many people actually had Mega CDs. So it wasn't exactly a lucrative place that publishers were trying to jump onto. But I think that Telnet sort of developed this idea, like, we can make a lot of money. You know, they probably made a lot of money off of their PC Engine games because they supported it for a long time really enthusiastically. Like, if we're sort of the best game in town for these sort of, like, lower-tier systems, we can have a lot of success and accomplish a lot. So they really went – like, they had launch games for the Mega CD. They had – because, you know, they'd done all these Mega Drive games. And they – supported it very heavily.
Right. It was also kind of the beginning of their converting weird Laserdisc arcade games.
Oh, yeah.
Which they have four of that I think if you look back in the pantheon of weird Laserdisc games from Japan are some of the better ones. Like,
yeah.
Like specifically, I think Time Gal is my favorite of
all. I'm a big fan of Time Gal.
I like Time Gal a lot.
If I could only, you know, like in versus like Space Ace or any of those, like I think it's fun and cute and wacky and fun to replay. And you know,
they published it in America for the Sega CD, Renovation.
Yep.
And Road Blaster and Cobra Command.
And Ninja Hayate, what's it called? It's got a different title.
What's Ninja Hayate called
in the U.S. for the Genesis, I think.
Something of the Ninja. It was the last one to come out here.
If you play Time Gal, she goes to the future, and I think it's like 2001 or something like that.
Right.
So.
Because, Laserdisc arcade game, it was from the early to mid-80s originally.
And if you were a Genesis fan watching the Japanese launch of Mega City, there were all these RPGs like Fey Area and Isle Lore. And you're like, oh, what are – you know, like we're so starved for RPGs over here, yet the Mega City is redolent with them.
The EGM previews and stuff at the time were like postage stamp size, two screenshots, mistranslate the titles of the games. Like, this is actually a fun fact. Like, so – Yeah, they put out this early launch-ish, if not launch, Mega CD RPG called Fey Area, F-H-E-Y space A-R-E-A. And – but, like, the katakana for that is Fey Area. And somehow, like, EGM got in its mind that it was, like, Feria, which is, like, an a NES RPG from a different publisher. And I rented Feria thinking it was, like, related like to Fey Area.
I have to say I played almost all their games last night for the Genesis, at least. And the titles are not at all indicative of what the games are. In this era of, like, SEO where this new Smash Brothers game is just called Smash Brothers, like, what is IO Lord? What is – like, I don't know if Dino Land is a pinball game or not. Like, just, like, they're not at all indicative of, like, are we playing.
You do not know what you're
Which
saying.
I like a lot, you know.
This was an era of discovery, both for the developers and for the players, I think. And it was, like, all filtered through this weird filter of, like, what's coming out in America? Like, what can we make a success of? Like, right. And the weird thing is, like, Soul Feast, so...
Well, I have Soul Feast here. Yeah. I think Soul Feast is one of the most unlikely pack-ins because it was a pack-in here for the Sega CD, so...
Well, the weirdest thing is, so Soul Feast was a launch game for the Mega CD in Japan. It's a 2D shooter. It's music's by Motoi Sakuraba.
The music's so over the top.
He did a lot of music for Wolf Team, and for, as we'll probably get to, essentially still does. Sega made it a pack-in with the Sega CD in Japan, in America. Sorry, Shane was showing me a visual aid, and I got totally confused.
He was pointing out a beautiful screenshot of Isle Load.
But at the same time, Renovation put out a cartridge version of it called Soldis.
Right, which doesn't have great music since it's not like, orchestrated.
I mean, it's probably got Sakuraba's music. I've actually never played the cartridge version, but like...
But it's a really solid shooter as well, actually. It has a lot of voices. It's good. They're good. So I'm kind of trending towards my dramatic assertion here that for those of us who were like Sega Genesis or TurboGrafx kids, this was kind of our like second-rate Konami and Capcom. Like, the quality level was consistently B minus or higher and very prolific and very Japanese. And I very rarely came away disappointed from a Renovation or Telenet product throughout my 16-bit days.
Like, yeah, I mean, I could totally see that.
They definitely they definitely did the thing where they – which is really started in the 16-bit era of like we will get a boost because our presentation is better than other people's. So like yes, the Valis games on a core gameplay level are not – like they're not as tight. They're not as responsive. They're not as thought through as like the high level, even some of the 8-bit games. But – they definitely made up for that with, like, atmosphere and just interestingness.
Yeah, and you see a real growth. Like, I think if you play the PC Engine Valis 1 remake, which is a Super CD, the cutscenes are actually quite good. And if you, like, watch a Valis 2 cutscene and then watch a Valis Phantasma Soldier cutscene, it's night and day of quality. And, like, you know, the gameplay feels tighter. The graphics are a lot better. And, like, Super Valis 4 for Super Nintendo – it's actually the best gameplay of the franchise. The game doesn't quite hang together quite as well. But.
So this is the weird thing about Telenet and actually Renovation. I found this out recently, actually. So they kept going through the Genesis, but as of course, you know, the Super Nintendo came out like in 1991. It became a big deal. And they started making Super Famicom games, just like a lot of other Japanese publishers. Like they got
Pachinko though, and golf.
No, they made
a few.
No, they made.
They made that really good one, Dream.
Psycho Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot remember the name of this game. Neuger.
Oh yeah, Neuger, which never came out here.
But it was announced, and Renovation was going to publish it. But Sega bought Renovation. That's what happened.
It was going to be called The Journey Home, right?
Right. So it got canceled for the U.S. I have the Japanese version. You do too, because I played it at your house. Yeah. That's how I got turned onto it. But like.
They're a little bit like a Game Freak in that way too. Like they never made Pokemon, but like you know they had consistent quality in 16-bit era.
They, I think, because they were so like it's weird. You say this like it's hard to believe, but yeah, they were kind of a big deal to Genesis. And I'm not sure. I'm assuming Sega bought them kind of to just kind of lock their games down or whatever. Not that it ended up having that effect, but Sega didn't buy Telnet though. They bought Renovation America,
right.
I think.
It's
very confusing. But like in the end, like they're Super Famicom games. The only ones I can think of that are really like Psycho Dream's cool.
Well, Psycho Dream is kind of a forgotten classic.
It's very.
Have you played it, Jeremy?
I haven't, but apparently an attempt to release it in the U.S. as Dream Probe never panned out.
I think you would really like it. Yeah,
I would love to try it.
It's a weird Valis-y kind of game. Like it's very
more psychedelic than Valis.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I'm all about discovering you know these kind of really interesting, maybe B-tier platformers and stuff from the 8-16-bit era that I never played before, because there's this wealth of them. And even stuff like this, like, no one ever talks about Psycho Dream. There's like the canon of games that Americans are like, oh, this was a great import-only game. But that's the sort of thing that kind of falls outside of that,
oh, yeah,
that
sure.
sort of narrow window. Those are really interesting to me.
I could spend a whole weekend playing Psycho Dream and Moon Crystal.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
Moon Crystal's
wonderful.
All right, so we've pretty well covered the basics about Telenet in fairly exhaustive detail. So,
well, we haven't gotten to the tragic denouement.
Well, we'll use that as kind of a bookend for the episode. But I think next we should talk about the Valise games, because that's kind of the main point of this episode. So we'll talk about that, and then we can wrap it up by talking about the sad fate of Telenet.
There's sad and happy fates to certain parts of it.
All right. But. Well, let's take a break now.
All right.
Right, so you guys have definitely relayed a lot of information about Telenet itself, but we've only kind of briefly made glancing touches on Valise.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the soul of this episode. So it would be great to get a little more into that. And again, it's pretty much going to be you guys talking because
I apologize.
I don't have a lot of experience with it personally. And like I've said, I've dabbled in Valise a little bit, and I just really can't get past the game mechanics, which are it doesn't quite gel the way that I want it
to.
It's
basically Castlevania.
It is, but the thing about Castlevania is that Castlevania works because everything fits together so well. And Valise is very much in that school of, like, I mean, it's, you know, it's a step above Eight Eyes or something like that, but it just, like,
All the
little parts, the level design, the character physics, all those things just don't gel the way that Castlevania
But I would say that
does.
every game has good ideas too, mm-hmm. unlike a lot of also-rans. Like, every game has some good gameplay ideas.
Right. And the storytelling consistently kind of overcompensates for the slightly wonky controls and level design. But, and the boss battles are decent too.
Yeah. I would say that the quick establishment of chronology here or something like that. So the Valise series
started in 1986.
But for the American release, like we talked about, the first was Valise 2 for the TurboGrafx-16 in 1990, followed by Valise 3 for the Genesis.
Right, but we're not just talking about the US games. But like, yeah, I think it's important to set the press, you know, right.
It is interesting because, you know, by the time I played Valise 1, I had already played 2 and 3. So it was, I think in America, like, unless you imported Valise 1 on PC 88 or something.
Which is zero people, probably.
We never got the beginning of the story until we played it on Genesis. And when you go back and play Valise 1, it seems really quaint and simple and small in scope in comparison to 2 and 3, because it is really just the story of Yuko and her friend finding out about the dark world. A lot of it takes place on Earth, actually. Whereas in Valise 2 and 3, you're going to these insane, weird, crazy locations and playing multiple characters.
The weird thing about Valise, or like the sort of – we talked about this. You know, it was part of the – like what was going on in like anime at the time. Essentially, the main protagonist is this girl, Yuko. She is actually a princess of Vikanti.
Vikanti.
Yeah, which is a sort of another realm. I was never clear when I was a kid if it was a spirit realm or if it was a real realm. I think it is a real realm.
She is an average high school senior who happens to possess a heart completely balanced with equal parts of yin and yang. She is, therefore, potentially the greatest warrior of all the worlds.
So she's not an average high school student.
Guess not.
It's kind of undercuts that.
It's misleading.
So, but she's being raised as
Look how shady her friend Reiko looks in the photo there. You can just tell Reiko is up to no good.
Oh, well, this is real art. Like, right? This is not like redrawn art inside the manual.
But if you can tell, her best friend is doomed by looking really sinister.
Yeah, Reiko Kirishima. Yeah. She is a high school student born into money but not love.
Oh.
But the gist of it is there's these two realms, Vikanti and Earth, And Yuko is actually a princess of Vikanti, but she has been placed into Earth and she is raised as a Japanese high school student.
Right.
She is the Valis warrior and she is called to defend Vikanti and Castle Vanity, Queen, what's her name?
Varunia?
Yes.
And, like, she later meets her sister, Volna slash Varna, in Valis 3. Yeah.
Is Castle Vanity a reference to Castlevania?
I hope so. It's like a, it's like a really, really beautiful Castlevania. Yeah.
Dracula's so, just like, I'm so gorgeous. But, that's more like the Alucard era, though. You know, the long, flowing tresses.
But so yeah, it's this sort of high concept, sort of like anime stuff going on. But essentially, yeah, you play like a Castlevania-ish game that starts in Tokyo and sort of ends up in Vikanti. And Vikanti is really fucked up. It's like a fantasy realm via like, yeah, it's sort of, it's
lots
hellish.
Of parallax clouds,
creepy
and
monsters, weird bruise-like colors.
Yeah, a lot of pink and purple.
Weird castles, two-headed tigers, that kind of crap.
Yeah, and for me, you know, it was not as good as Ninja Gaiden or Castlevania, but it was that with like sexy girls in sailor suits and demons, like, you know. Yeah.
Which, like, I think that like they do something interesting. Like I said, they do something interesting with every game. Like Valis 2 is actually really meat and potatoes. It's like a floaty Castlevania-ish game.
Right.
But it has a lot of atmosphere. And that was definitely enough for me in 1990.
And then Valis 3 has the three playable characters, which play very differently. And I really enjoyed playing as like Cham. A, she has a whip, so it suddenly feels like Castlevania when you play as her. And then the other character, Volna, she's more of a magician, so it felt like playing as Sifa in Castlevania 3. So that one had a lot of replay. I beat Valis 3 like multiple times on Genesis and had a really good time of it.
Yeah. And then Valis 4, which didn't come out. Wait, is there a version
Super
of
Valis 4?
Yeah, no, there is
not. It only came out for Super Nintendo in North America. So, I don't think it came out for Mega Drive in Japan either.
It's PC Engine. Yeah, I think they dropped the Mega Drive at a certain point. But it's PC Engine, not TurboGrafx, because by that point TurboGrafx had pretty much died. There's a Super Nintendo version that was put out by Atlus because, as we talked about, like Renovation got acquired by Sega, so they didn't do any of their own Super Nintendo games.
It has the best control, for sure.
It definitely does. It has really good music, even though it's not a CD game. But it doesn't have much in the way of cinematics because it's not a CD game. But it does carry – like the Valis series has this – I think it's pervasive atmosphere of just sort of like weird, unsettling world being dragged into it and having to deal with it is kind of – does add something that's sort of intangible. And you can't say like, yes, these are better than Castlevania games because they're not. But it's not as trivial as like, ooh, good graphics. You know, for me, it actually brought something to the
table. Did you go back and play the Valis Phantasm Soldier for Super CD?
I've played it. I didn't finish it.
Because I think it is actually maybe the best one.
Mm. It was probably the last one.
It was the last one. And I think it shows you that they actually had this idea of going back and like remastering and making this director's cut, re-envisioning the series. And I think that
The remake just totally threw out the original game's level design and just started basically from the top up, bottom up.
And, you know, I think a lot of us kind of hoped that one day maybe this would get revived either with a new one or a remake instead years later.
Yeah. Oh.
Have we – before we get into horror, can we – I mean, have we communicated what makes Valis interesting to people like you two who –
talked much about the story at all. I mean, you've said, you know, there's Yuko and she's like the queen or the princess, but –
does her mother die? There's
lots of death.
There's lots of death.
Yeah. That's it's very macabre and melodramatic.
You know, one of the really interesting things about the series that makes it stand out in its time is its emphasis on women. Like it's predominantly female characters. The protagonist and the antagonist tend to be largely women. There are some male
antagonists. There's some big male antagonists. Yeah.
But they tend to be like
Rogles.
Yeah, Rogles.
They tend to be more like demonic beasts as opposed to humanoids.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. Like it's got these sort of like the kind of the Voltron thing of like these people are basically human, but they're not quite like in terms of the antagonists. Like some of the like the Rogueless army, those people who are like
half man, half bird.
Well, I just meant more meant like just like they're guy but with blue skin,
right?
like wearing crazy armor. They threaten and they're like the sort of the driving force. But behind like you know I have to go eventually confront this guy. But ultimately, yeah, is about like Yuko and her friends who are – they're like I don't think there are any male playable characters
in the
franchise.
It's all females. Hmm. Yeah.
And this was like – it's funny. It's like I hate having to say this. It's like before the modern era of like really over the top like making them all like sex objects, like it's actually – they were just cool characters.
Yeah. I mean I know – I think was it the – the Turbo version of the remake. One of them has a lot of like panty flashing in the cutscenes.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm not pretending that it's like this was the much tamer 20 years ago version of the same kind of idea. Feels, like we're putting in female characters.
Even these super deformed SD Valis, like the ultimate unlockable is like a tiny itty bitty bikini on this like SD version of you.
Yeah, that's what we should talk about. Like Cid of Valis, as it's called in the US.
That one was always interesting to me because I saw, you know, I'd go to the rental stores and see, you know, the Valis games. And then there was Cid of Valis. And I was like, what?
Because in Japan,
is this? Who is
Cid? This happens where they make.
And then later, I discovered it was SD.
Right. They make a super deformed version of a popular franchise, but it never comes out in America. We don't get SD Gundam. We don't get SD Splatterhouse, but we got SD Valis somehow.
Didn't we get Virtua Fighter Kids?
We did.
That's the one we did.
Yeah, but it's weird because it's actually a remake of Valis 2.
Right.
And it's the only version of Valis 2 for the Sega hardware. Like, if you want to play Valis 2, you have to play it on PC.
Yeah, 1, 2, and 3 came out, but only as Cid of Valis.
So it's – and it's really cute and really long and
– and it actually has regular real art on the cover, whereas Renovation went to strange lengths to change the art for every other Valis
But
release.
The thing is, it doesn't – the cover of the American version does have SD Valis characters, but it also has SD Cosmic Fantasy characters SD characters from another franchise because it's like – in Japan, it was the cover of, like, a board game.
Oh, wow.
That had – of, like, a Renovation board game that had, like, all of their characters.
Wow, board game.
So it's like, well, I don't know why they didn't use the Japanese cover of SD Valis.
Yeah.
They wanted to use Japanese
as a Valis fan, I was excited to buy Cid of Valis.
Like, me too.
Cid Barrett of Valis.
Mm. I was very confused because, like – I bought it at the time. And actually, this is kind of the weird tension I had at the time. Like, so I was introduced to the series via Valis 2. It was a CD game. It had the cutscenes and stuff. And, like, I'd see then Valis 3 came out for the Genesis before it came out for the TurboGrafx. And I was like...
Did you feel betrayed?
Not betrayed, but I was like, I had this, I want to buy it. I want to buy Valis 3. I want to buy Valis 3, but I'm not going to. I'm going to wait. I'm going to, like, see if there's...
It was months later, though.
Yeah, I was like, I just, like, had this... And then I didn't end up buying Valis 3 for the TurboGrafx because, like, whatever, things had moved on or whatever. But, like, yeah, I had this... But I did break down and buy Cid Valis because it was definitely different and it wasn't, like, a duplication or whatever. And, like, that is a fun game. It's very... It's got the same melodramatic, like, complicated story as the Valis 2 where, like, you know, the characters like, you know, like Reiko, the girl we just alluded to who was rich but did not have love, ends up becoming the antagonist and dying during Valis 1.
In your arms, yeah.
And then she resurrects as, like, a spirit and, like, sort of advises you in the beginning of Valis 2. And she still comes back as, like, a spirit.
Cute spirit.
Yeah. It's like... I don't know. There's just enemies are creepy in that like Japanese like demonic sort of creepy way that things can be. It's just definitely But like the story of actual Valis, like I don't know that I have a coherent story in my head of like what the franchise is at the time it was like flashes of cool ideas and cool images to me because first of all Valis 1 had come out. Second of all, like there's a limitation to how much storytelling you can even do on a CD game of the time and then I didn't continue with the franchise.
But
so,
by the time of Valis
at the time.
3, you discover that you're like, you know, this chosen one who's been like, you know, a reincarnated heroine who has to save the world and your sister is there. And it's kind of this other reality that is your life that Yuko is now kind of forced to constantly summon back to like save the world over and over again. She's not. She's more of a, you know, adult
she's essentially
by the time of 3.
Like a goddess as well. Yeah. Like essentially, at the end of Valis 3, she essentially, I think she dies, doesn't she? And she
She transcends, doesn't she?
I think
she does.
Becomes
a goddess.
She becomes a goddess at the end of 3. And
she goes full Luna.
Yeah, Yuko is not the protagonist of 4. No, it's like some redheaded chick. I forget her name.
Yeah, at 4 I really lose track of like what the story's about.
Yeah. But
I mean,
the
character in 4 is basically Yuko but a palette swap.
Right, but I think it's meant to take place in the past, you know, after Yuko's ascended and like the next generation of, you know,
she might even show up in the cutscenes or something.
Maybe
I don't know.
That's the one I've only played through once.
I have this. It sounds so stupid because I've owned these games for so long, but at some point I do need to sit down and actually like sequentially play through all the PC Engine Valis games and beat them.
Yeah, I've played through them all in the last 10 years, but not in the last few years. And, you know, I think they do hold up to an extent if you were there. If you've never played these games, I think Valis 3 would be the one to go for first because it is really the peak. If you're going to play one, play through Valis 3. It's also the longest. It's probably like twice or three times as long as the first.
Are you talking about Genesis or the
– I think Genesis is probably the most playable. Just the controller is better. That's one of the things, having extra buttons. Like the high jump is on its own button on Genesis, whereas on PC Engine, you have to like press up and jump, and it's a little wonky.
Yeah.
And high jump's kind of important in Valis 3. Yeah.
I would also say that, like, I mean, we do live in the YouTube era. Like, you can just get a taste of what these games are about by watching YouTubes. I kind of hate recommending that to people because what I don't like is when people completely rely on that, like, and then form an opinion because, like, you can't quite get there. But
and I was saying while we're on break, you know, recently I went back and bought a CRT monitor because I wanted to play my games in the way that they originally appeared and to see the actual sprites in bright colors. And, like, it really does make a difference if you play this game on a tube versus watching a YouTube video or playing it on HD.
You can get an upscaler and that way.
I mean, we're going to get to the point where emulation is actually going to – they're starting to get to the point where they're using, like, shaders and stuff to make things look great.
Right. And, God, what game was it I was playing that actually has television tube distortion?
Was it, like, the Final Fight Capcom thing on Xbox?
Oh, it was something else, but there's
– there's a few games that have been doing it.
I was playing an M2 game that had that recently.
Oh, yeah, the M2 GB 3DS games.
Yeah.
And I was – while looking back at the history of Telenet, I was a little shocked that they never really fell into making more Game Boy and Game Gear stuff. They have like one game for each as far as I can tell. It's just kind of surprising because of that era a lot of times
– I mean they may just not have been happy with the reduced power of those systems. They seem to be a company that no matter what was always trying to make a pretty, you know, high-end visual audio experience.
Yeah. What they were drawn to, I think, about the PC Engine was the fact that it was a CD because they did not make – I don't think they made a single cartridge, turbo chip, Hue card, whatever you want to call it, for the system. They only made CD games. And then obviously the appeal of the Mega Drive –
Apparently that's wrong. Apparently I was looking at the list and they did like – they did the weirdly bad version of Golden Axe for PC Engine.
What? Was that not a CD?
No, it was a chip.
Oh.
I think. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think
– maybe it's a CD.
I think it's a CD, but they also were probably drawn to the Mega Drive because it was the most powerful raw power of the 16-bit systems. Really, and I guess it's hard to say, but you know, Super Nintendo has its own things that it does. But,
right.
And I guess as we approach the gentle denouement of Telnet, as 16-bit wanes and 32-bit comes out, they quickly kind of find themselves a relic. You know,
well, like, things changed a lot during that generation.
Yeah.
And probably selling their U.S. division probably – I don't know what the thinking behind it was, but probably didn't put them in a good position to continue to like make new fans or whatever really.
They did port those Laserdisc games in Japan
probably
over to PlayStation 1 and Saturn.
But also like probably I would guess like putting all your eggs in the Mega CD basket was probably not – the best basket to put your eggs
in. Well, because I'm sitting here with one of their only PS1 games, a game called Cybernetic Empire, which is like kind of a strange mix of like CG cutscenes and real-time action with adventure elements. Like it just doesn't – I played a little bit of it. I think, Christian, you tried it too.
Yeah, I've tried it but I never really
– it just doesn't feel like anything they had done previously.
Right.
It really wasn't up to par with –
yeah, it just didn't – it felt like a generic PlayStation 1 game.
Right.
So much so that I just didn't care.
There were so many Japanese developers that just couldn't make the jump from 2D to 3D. Yesterday we did an episode on the Tiny Toon games and or recently we recorded an episode on the Tiny Toon Adventure games and talked about Treasure, and Treasure was one of those companies. They just did not get into 3D gracefully and they managed to survive a lot longer than some of these other publishers, developers.
Right. Though you can
because
point to 3D games they made though that are great.
What's that?
You can point to 3D games Treasure made, like Cinepunishment.
Yeah.
But they were around that same era they were, you know, like the stretch panics of the world.
It was a tough time for them. It was a tough transition, and they've kind of dropped off the face of the earth.
Right. It just seems
they managed to weather, the generational transition into 32-bits.
Well, they did a lot
more gracefully But I was going to say during the Saturn era, they just kept doing 2D stuff, and they did it better than anyone. And they really kind of pushed the limits of 2D. And I feel like there weren't a lot of other developers that continued to carve that niche for themselves.
Well, if we talk about Wolf Team and what actually happened to Wolf Team, then we're going to sort of mirrors what you're talking
about. I think around the same time of Telenet making this thing with Wolf Team's name on it, Wolf Team was becoming Tails Studio, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I want the dirt on this.
Yeah. why don't we talk about Wolf Team? Because it is kind of an important...
at least to cap it off.
Yeah.
Well, it's a happy ending.
It's okay. Actually, why don't we talk about the sad ending first?
Oh, God.
So Valise had not totally vanished off the face of the earth. After the PC Engine and Sega CD era, oh, man, you guys look so sad right now.
It's better to...
It disappeared for a while, and then...
Telnet
bought a visual novel publishing company, right?
What really happened, I think, actually, if I recall correctly, and I'm sure this is probably somewhere in like either your Internet Archive with Insert Credit or it or it's still up on Insert Credit. Like, there was this need to generate money. The 3D games like Cybernetic Empire were not doing it. Telnet was slowly constricting and dying, I think, and essentially they got to the point where, well, we need some money. Let's turn Valise into porn. Let's just put it out.
Oh.
Did they make her moe?
No, the characters are
she went hard. She went hardcore.
They look like, you know, contemporary renditions of the 80s style. So sharper, harder designs. Not as foofy hair. The eyes aren't quite as big and shiny, but generally the same thing. It's just they're naked and, you know, I think they said there are a lot of female characters in this series. We can make them all have sex.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really disappointing legacy for a series that was so predominantly represented by women, you know, by female protagonists and antagonists. They all were just turned into sex meat.
I did notice in the PC 88 games and maybe the other microcomputer games, there is a little bit of nudity, you know, but it's not like excessive.
In the games that came out for, you know, Turbo and Genesis, no nudity.
A
little bit of suggestive games, kind of, you know, tentacle.
There was like side
stuff.
Nipple, but it was nothing explicit. Like, you know, typical for anime of the time, a little bit of toplessness.
I think every microcomputer game needed some, like at least one boob in it.
That seemed to be kind of the way of things. But Valise takes it way beyond.
Well, it's good. It was called Valise X. That pretty much tells you everything you need to know. I think it was a... I've never experienced it. I don't really. I saw some tastefully cropped screenshots that were not still seared into my brain of Yuko in carnal distress.
The art wasn't, you know, 100% perfect with what it used to look like.
Well, no, I mean, we're just talking about it. It was Yuko. Like, let's face it. But that was the last gasp of the Valise franchise.
I'll say it's one of the sadder ways for a franchise to go out.
I think of every series we've ever talked about on Retronauts, that is actually the worst and most inappropriate, unfitting, unwanted ending.
So was it just a visual novel then?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering what the genre was.
It wasn't like Falsetto More or something like that where it's like soft titillation in between or Steam Hearts or something, soft titillation in between, you know, standard gameplay, like action gameplay. It was pretty much visual novel.
Yeah, I think it was just like, let's wring some money out of this franchise. Like, we have this IP. It's got some value to it. Like, we'll turn it into visual novel and sell it to the, like, Arrowgate crowd on the PC. And that's what happened.
I'm almost glad it didn't take off and become, like, you know, a porn
festival. Let's face it, as Jeremy's saying, it's, like, not a good fit, right?
No.
It's also not a good fit for, like, the people who play Arrowgate, as far as I can tell, mostly want, like, you know, different kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Than Valise.
Probably provides. Younger characters, too.
So.
She's already a high school senior. That's kind of an old lady there.
Yeah, you know, one of the girls in Senran Kagura is supposed to be 13, I think.
How do they localize that?
I think they make her 14.
She talks about college a lot.
I'm really looking forward to majoring in
Ninja arts.
Anyway, so that's the sad ending, but there's a happy ending too.
Well, we should say, you know, the other part of the sad ending is that, or I guess a kind of a happy ending is that Valise X did not save Telenet's bacon and that the company dissolved in 2007. And like Shane mentioned, its rights, at least especially to the Wolf Team stuff, have been sold to Sunsoft.
Yeah, no, I think the rights
by all
to
accounts.
I think the rights to everything are under Sunsoft.
And apparently a lot of their games are available on Project Egg, which is a Japanese digital distribution service. I wish Ray were here because he really knows a lot about it. But it's you know, something similar to Steam or PSN or whatever, but it's kind of specifically for Japanese stuff.
And like I think it started out of Japan.
Yeah, I think it started out as an MSX service and kind of expanded into other things. So
on Japanese PCs.
So there, you know, the properties have not been totally forgotten, but they just haven't
been
made available here.
Some of it's on Japanese PSN as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The PC Engine games.
But the single like aggregator for it is Project Egg. And then there are little bits and pieces of the Telenet and the Valise legacies here and there around other services. But again, all in Japan.
Because Sunsoft still exists. They just don't really make games anymore. They just sort of manage their IP.
Yeah, I mean, I saw their booth at TGS.
Really? They had a booth?
Yeah, they had a booth right next to the women-oriented the dating game thing where you could ladies could go and pose with
a dude. Yeah, that.
Well, it was women dressed as men, Yeah,
I walked past.
It was like it was all romantic and it was really interesting because it was a real contrast to the semi-naked booth babes that otherwise dot the floor.
But actually, so Sunsoft had a booth. Just out of curiosity, what were they showing at TGS?
They weren't. It was basically like nothing. It was.
Okay,
I actually thought that dating thing was Sunsoft's booth, but it was like adjacent to Sunsoft's
booth.
Probably
just like you can come and have a meeting with us. To
yeah, it was pretty much for meetings, but it was on the floor as opposed to being off in the like the international business area or whatever.
Huh. So yeah, Sunsoft owns the rights to the games. This is just the way it is now. Like essentially. I don't know if I could talk about this.
Well, but at least the rights are known quantity and they're owned by
a real company.
A real company that will theoretically allow them to be licensed again or to be published again.
My curiosity is piqued now. What is it you can't talk about?
Victor Ireland convinced Sunsoft when he had that brief period of working with Sunsoft, convinced them to buy the rights to the Telenet catalog because he wanted them to be able to have access to it.
Right. Okay.
Well, I'll say I do work with Victor because he is involved with, Gaijin and Monkey Ball.
And Class of Heroes and that sort of thing.
Class of Heroes 3G coming out soon for PS3.
Is it?
Yeah, it's actually – it's in production – physical production.
Good.
But I mean the reason is because I think it got – I think essentially it was a good idea because he had a really close relationship with Sunsoft at the time, but then Sunsoft changed direction again and sort of the games are stuck in that vault now and they're kind of inaccessible. Then there's – I don't know what the best hope would have been, if someone could have accessed them otherwise.
I think there's still inroads to get to them. So I think hope springs eternal for this stuff. I think that hopefully it won't be buried.
So anyway, let's finish up by talking about the happy ending of the Telenet legacy.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny.
The real happy ending.
It's funny because Tales now seems like this ubiquitous, crazy thing. But when Tales of Phantasia was first announced, it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tales of Phantasia for the SNES, which was made by Wolf Team. I don't understand. This is what I don't understand. How did Namco contract Wolf Team? How did this happen? Do you know?
Okay, so I tried reading about this, and again, it's all kind of sketchy and different sources say different things. But it sounds like – I think I wrote it down. Where was that? Okay, so in the – I want to say early 90s, the Wolf Team division was actually spun off from Telenet and made its own external individual – entity, and they continued to work closely with Telenet, but I think at that point they were also allowed to contract with other developers and publishers. And then Telenet actually bought a stake or whatever and sort of reabsorbed Wolf Team again, and then something else happened and the company – the Wolf Team was actually fully reabsorbed into Telenet, but I don't think the Wolf Team was really happy about that. And they all left and formed a company called Triace. And I think that the Tales of Phantasia debacle actually sort of sowed the seeds of them leaving. From my understanding is that Namco wanted a lot of changes that they weren't happy about. So they basically said, no, we're going to go do our own thing. I don't know. It's all really
– I understand first of all, the Triace Wolf Team thing and how that happened and then how Tales people essentially – because talked about this way early on.
Basically, the Wolf Team people left and formed Triace. Mm-hmm. And so Telenet was stuck with this name, an empty shell basically, and said, Namco still has this contract with them to make Tales games, so let's refill Wolf Team with new talent, and they rehired new people in to Wolf Team. Mm. And they continued to make Tales games for Namco and became Tales Studio. But they're not the same Wolf Team. Like,
but I'm not.
The old Wolf Team is now Tri-Ace.
All of them left or just a few key members?
Like, I think it was a lot of them.
The thing is, I guess the one thing that makes me suspicious that it's not 100% of everyone left is because Motoi Sakuraba stuck with the Tales franchise. The composer.
But
who was,
composers tend to be free agents.
Right. Yeah, he's but not, also yeah. Japanese people tend to be very relationship-based. Like, why would they stick with a franchise they had no connection to?
Yeah, but I've seen that happen a lot with composers where they'll kind of work both sides of the field.
Yeah, I'm interested. I'd love to know more about what
but
happened.
But having played Fantasia, it does have a lot of the spirit of old classic Wolf Team.
I have a feeling there's some people who still – maybe it's still there.
But then I do see some of that spirit going off into Tri-Ace games as well. But it gets a little further away. Like when you play Tales of Fantasia, you can see bits of like cosmic, you know
– cosmic fantasy.
Yeah, in it.
Like the thing about like old – even like the older Tales games, like they definitely have a lot of that kind of spirit. But the other thing is like if you play like old Tri-Ace games and old – Tales games, like you definitely see that they're not like they're kissing cousins. Like it's obvious from the interfaces and the way they play stuff.
Yeah.
So it's
Tales of Destiny and Star Ocean 2, like they're kind of the same thing in a lot of ways.
So it's interesting. But yeah, essentially like this becomes a sad ending again, considering the last thing fucking Trice made was Lightning fucking Returns. So like
I like that game.
I recently started Resonance of Fate.
I rolled my eyes. That doesn't come across on
In fact,
on
you talking about the battle system made me want to start it.
Oh, awesome. I'm proud.
So. We'll see if I get through it.
Yeah, Tri-Ace is it seems to be more of a a contractor now.
I just think there's not a lot of options.
Yeah, probably.
So is Tri-Crescendo like the shadows on the wall of Wolf Team?
I don't even know what Tri-Crescendo
is. Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, no, Tri-Crescendo is interesting because
were they what's that called? Eternal Sonata? Did they do that
game?
Yeah.
And Baten Kaitos.
Mm. Oh, that's good.
I thought Baten Kaitos was Monolith.
It is. It's both. Like if you turn I just turned on a copy of Baten Kaitos like a month and a half ago and it says Monolith Soft, Tri-Crescendo, or maybe in the other order.
But Xenoblade is just Monolith, right?
Yeah.
Okay. No try there.
Also, during the era of, like, for some reason when Monolith, instead of saying Monolith Soft, their logo said MLSI for whatever reason during Baten Kaitos. I don't know why. For a while it
Monolith
switched.
Software Incorporated?
Yeah, presumably. But for some reason they just they changed the logo for a while and then it changed back.
But so back to Tales Studio. It's funny. Tales Studio is still running, made like Zillia. But, like, we were imagining that none of those people were ex-Wolf Team guys anymore.
I don't know. Like, the thing is, like, so there was always this sort of fanny supposition. We're getting to the territory of like what I understand is definitely not 100% real, but like there was this feeling that like there was Team Destiny, as it was called colloquially, and sort of Team Symphonia. And Symphonia was the GameCube one.
It was good.
Full 3D. It's a good game. But there were 2D ones. Like they kept making 2D ones for a long time. It took them a long time to jump into 3D. And sort of the first 3D Destiny one is Tales of Graces F. And you can actually see like the parallel, like Destiny 2 for the PlayStation, some of the ideas from that were actually reused in Tales of Graces F. So you can definitely tell there's like someone on the creative side kept that line going, whereas the Symphonia side had the full 3D LMBS that you could like,
right.
Like Symphonia went into Vesperia, etc. Anyway, there's definitely people. There's like, I would bet money there's people there who are still from those days. I just don't know enough about it to actually explain what is happening.
Yeah, I mean, probably some. But I looked for names and I couldn't find names to say, like, who left Wolf Team, who was Wolf Team. But like, that information, it just doesn't exist, at least not in the English-speaking
web. I would almost argue that Tales is like, the most reliable traditional JRPG franchise that hasn't gone any weird directions, hasn't gone free-to-play, hasn't gone...
Hasn't gone to an MMO. You know,
yeah, like, Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, everybody's gone strange left turns. Tales has pretty much stayed on course.
And kind of plays like
a game you would have played
Mega
on...
10. Megaton has not.
It's had weirder offshoots, but you know the mainline has remained.
That's
pretty,
true. Just very. It's less frequent. Like Tales, like I think, and I actually talked to Baba, the producer of Tales, recently, and like that is kind of the task they have set themselves with. Like we will be reliable.
Yeah.
Like I mean, it does lead to some level of cliche, like a tremendous level of cliche at times. Mm-hmm. But like they're like, we will be reliable. We will be the game that like fans can count.
But at the same time, like any Tales game that comes out, kind of in a way, will play like a game that would have come out for PC Engine CD or Omega CD. And that's kind of encouraging in an era when everyone has tried so hard to make, you know, Lightning Returns or, you know, Dragon Quest 11.
11? 10.
10.
9. 12.
Dragon 34. Quest 11 is awesome, guys. I don't know if you've seen anything about it yet, but
I mean, I
so
see
good.
Your point. Like, Tales is is good. I am definitely not in the Lightning Returns deserves to exist camp. So I am. I would think the Earth would be a better planet without the game.
It's weird that like Tails is so reliable, but everything Trice makes used to be so different. Like the weirdest ideas, the weirdest battle systems. Like everything was always just so. Yeah, I don't know. The things you haven't seen before.
I mean, the weirdness has become kind of codified. Like all the things that made those games stand out and strange are just like those are the foundations of that series now. Like Tails, when it started out, was really interesting because you had this combat system that was real time and it actually drew a little bit of influence from fighting games. Like you were pressing button combos to attack and like there was even kind of, especially
combo
in Destiny, like like you could break combos, break defense, you had fireball type motions and uppercuts and things like that. And that was weird. That was like – I'd never played an RPG like that when Tales of Destiny came out and it was really kind of intoxicating and exciting. And now all the Tales games do that. That's just how they are. Like I said, the sort of strangeness has been codified and where Tales of Phantasia, Tales of Destiny were at one – you know, they were kind of like pushing new ideas and doing strange mergers of genres. I think maybe that was just true for Phantasia and Tales of Destiny. I remember the ad campaign for that in the US was like, this is why you got into RPGs in the first place. It was actually pushing back against Final Fantasy VII and all the games that were moving into 3D and saying, no, this is classic. Except at the same time, it was still like that really funky action RPG system. So like it managed to balance that like innovation and, you know, classic nostalgia.
Yeah.
And there's not really – there's not really that innovation in the Tales games anymore.
I remember actually, when I played Destiny, which was the first one that got released in the U.S., like, I had just come off of Xenogears, which is, like, the, like, full 3D, super...
And the story couldn't be more traditional compared to Xenogears.
And I was just like, this is like a breath of fresh air. And that's how I felt at the time.
Yeah, no, I did too. Although, the story definitely, like, it feels like it ends, and then there's the whole second half of the game. So in that sense, it was kind of like the way RPGs are now today. Like, you guys could have cut it off. It's like the Christopher Nolan problem. Just, no, we don't need that whole half of the game epilogue.
Well, and if Tri-Ace has a bit of the DNA of Wolf Team and Telenet as well, I do kind of view them similarly. Like consistent B-level output rarely getting me to like AAA excitement. But I'm always, you know, if they're a work-for-hire team, like for example, they're doing Phantasy Star Nova, I'm pretty confident.
Are they?
Yeah, Phantasy Star Nova is Tri-Ace.
Yeah, and I'm confident that it'll be proficient. It looks pretty good.
Like, yeah, I played a little of that at TGS and liked it.
Like I think Tri-Ace, much like Wolf Team, it's like they get the job done. Mm-hmm. So
I'm looking forward to the Steam release of that in America.
Is that announced?
No, it's just after the success of Valkyria Chronicle on Steam. I feel like Sega is only going to publish its Japanese games on Steam now in the U.S.
But no, it's true. Like I was always like I always feel like if I don't get to play a Tri-Ace game, at least try it. I'm missing out. Like I always want to try that 3DS one they did for Konami that I cannot.
What was it called? Yeah. I forget. Did it come out here? Or
was that
Japan?
Was that the dungeon crawler?
Yeah. Pretty.
Into the labyrinth or something?
Yeah, nice visuals.
I don't remember. I'm not going to remember.
Yeah, I played it at TGS and wrote a preview on it for 1UP a few years back.
Yeah. So.
But I guess, you know, in this modern era, we're often talking about the middle having dropped out of of the games that get published, that everything's either a tiny indie game or a huge AAA blockbuster. I feel like Telnet existed in that wonderful middle ground of B-level warmth and splendor, and that like actually that their you know the legacy kind of does continue with Tri-Ace.
Yeah, and you know even though I was never into Telnet games and only kind of tried to appreciate them maybe a little too late, like I still feel their loss. I still I miss that part of the games industry.
Yeah,
and I wish that there were a space for companies like Telnet to exist, but there really isn't. There's just a handful like Atlas, Marvelous, like just a few. It's really it's frustrating. Like the big publishers aren't willing to step into that space anymore.
And so many people are just like, if you look at the kind of stuff like the sort of mid tier stuff that comes out of Japan, like Demon Gaze or Criminal Girls or whatever, it just has that like patina of filth on it that you just don't want to deal with.
Yeah, Criminal Girls had just come out the week when I was in Japan for TGS, and I was looking through Famitsu, and some of the outfits they're wearing were just puffs of smoke and or shower suds that was paid DLC. I was like, yeah, no.
That was announced for a U.S. release, wasn't it? One of them?
Not yet.
Demon Gaze came out already.
No. One of the Criminal Girls was announced
for the
U.S.
I thought so, too.
Yeah, I think maybe.
I think it was.
Oh, really? Wow.
It sounds like an NIS America joint.
I will say, you know, like that niche of, you know, very Japanese-y gal games is kind of growing popularity here on Vita. I mean, there's fans of it.
So. I just thought the games are also usually very mediocre, I think, which is another – and not in a charming way.
Yeah, I mean, the Senran Kagura Bon Appetit cooking game just came out. So if you want to play that, you can.
If you want to refer to like chapter like 1 through 50 of me complaining about this shit, you can just listen to TinyCast. I'll spare you.
Ooh.
Fair enough.
We'll do.
All right. So final thoughts on Valius and Telenet. Or did we already go through that?
I don't know. Like, my final thoughts
final statement.
Did, but my final statement is just like, I just feel a warmth. I mean, it's situational, right? Like I said, I discussed this all. Like, it was the time, the era we lived in, my age, like what these games creatively accomplished. But like, I feel a real, like, genuine fondness for these games. And I think that, yeah, it harks back to an era that we don't live in now. Like, there's definitely a lot of stuff happening in the indie scene, but there was a sense of discovery and just like, what the hell are these people trying to do?
That's something you said earlier that really resonated with me, is that, you know, it was a Wild West experience for players and for developers. Like, everyone was trying to figure out, what are these video games? Like, what works? What doesn't? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, on the player side, it was like, what do I like? And what's fun? And what's out there? And what are people trying to do? And that really doesn't exist anymore. The territory has been too well charted out. And as much as I like, you know, indie games, I feel like almost every notable indie game is it's recompiling other people's ideas and other genres and finding interesting and fun new configurations for those things. And that's great, but I do miss the sense of like, whoa, what is this? I did not think a video game could be like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with everything Christian said. And I think that also, like, you know, there's a lot of love for franchises like Ninja Gaiden and Castlevania. And, like, those are two of my favorites. But I think that a franchise like Valius actually, you know, exists in that same pantheon, not at quite the same level. But if you've never seen these games and go back and experience them, I think you'd be surprised at what you found. And like, allow yourself to be of that moment when the people in Japan were inspired by what was happening in anime and film and books. And you know, I think – go back and experience these, even if you have to just watch them. But there's something of value here and something that we probably won't see happen again.
Yeah, I think this is one of those instances where inconsistent localization and you know, less than popular platform lifetimes really kind of did the series a disservice. Because, you know, like you guys said, your first experience was Valius 2. So you never even got to see the beginning of the story until after Valius 4.
Right.
So it's just one of those things where we didn't really get to experience the games as they happened, especially those of us who, say, didn't buy a Turbo Duo or Turbo PC, CD. So yeah, it's like hidden history almost for most people.
And I think the other takeaway to just remind people about Gaiares. Gaiares is actually legitimately a great game, like a 9 out of 10, like with amazing gameplay, music, and control. Yeah.
Guys with mullets love it. All right. Well, thanks, guys. I'm glad this finally happened.
Yeah.
I hope everyone listening at home feels like the 5-year wait has been worth it. So we'll go ahead and wrap now. This has been Retronauts. You can find us at retronauts.com, on iTunes, where we're Retronauts, Retronauts on Twitter, Retronauts on Tumblr, blah, 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 Retronauts. Everywhere Retronauts. But most importantly, on Patreon, where you can support us and help us pay for our recording fees and things like that. So please consider doing that. It'd be great. We'll send you stickers. Why don't you guys tell us about yourselves, where to find
you. Wait, is Retronauts on Tinder?
No.
Not yet.
We're not trying to hook up.
Just checking.
Sorry, ladies.
Our show is a love connection in and of itself. So yeah, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on usgamer.net, where I write stuff and edit stuff and stuff. I'm on Twitter as GameSpite. I run GameSpite.net, which is my blog, and GameBoyWorld.com, which is an insane historical project that I'm doing for some reason. You guys?
So I'm Christian Nutt. You can find me on GamaSutra.com, where I also write and edit stuff and curate stuff. It's crazy.
Wow.
I'm busy.
You're like a museum master.
And then you can find me on Twitter at Ferricide, Ferricide. That's pretty much it. That's where I'm at.
You can find me on Twitter at Shane Watch, all one word, Shane Watch.
Oh, hi.
That's it?
That's it.
That's your entire online presence?
You can feel his love and skill emanating from your PlayStation console.
As you're playing Senran Kagura Bon Appetit, and you're like, oh, yes, Shane.
No, if you're playing, if you're playing The Binding of Isaac Rebirth, which is my game of the year 2014, that is you can feel my power through that.
I'm on Twitter, too. I was actually on this episode. You guys might not know that, but I was here the whole time.
Bob was keeping the audio levels adjusted.
I was just sitting back and basking in. I was waiting for this episode, too, so, you know. I was one of the people complaining, but you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write for US Gamer and Something Awful, so check out those sites too, please. Yep.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back again in 2 weeks with more audio noise to fill your ear holes.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.